Lecture 1, The Early History of National Socialism and Hitler.
The question that's before us, I think, as we begin any of our discussions about the rise and fall of the Third Reich, is why study the National Socialist experience? Why look at the Third Reich? It is, after all, a morbid, depressing, even terrifying topic. And yet it's a topic that has to be addressed, has to be analyzed, has to be coped with. In many ways, I would argue it's the pivotal experience of 20th century Western civilization, linking political, economic, social, and moral issues that stand at the very core of our experience in the 20th century. In other words, we can't afford not to try and understand what National Socialism meant, where it came from, who supported it, why, and how the regime was able to achieve, or almost achieve, its terrifying ideological objectives. It's obviously more than an intellectual problem. The balance of power in the world was fundamentally altered by the Nazi regime, bringing in the wake of the Second World War the eclipse of Europe and the rise of the two great superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. In the process, millions of people lost their lives, either in the war itself or as a result of Nazi terror and mass extermination. Millions more found their lives forever altered by the Nazi regime and continue to live with the implications of National Socialist actions today. In addition to these powerful factors, there is, I think, another that helps to explain the continuing fascination, indeed sometimes I think obsession, with National Socialism and the Third Reich. 45 years after the collapse of the Third Reich, as you know, it's impossible to pass a newsstand or go into a bookstore without finding sheafs of magazine articles and books dealing with National Socialism, the Third Reich, or with Adolf Hitler. Indeed, National Socialism is the most widely researched, discussed, and written about topic in our star-crossed century. Is it the horror, the deaths, that account for the haunting presence of National Socialism in our psyche? In part, I think the answer is obviously yes. And yet the Soviet regime under Stalin, or the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot, systematically exterminated larger proportions of their populations. Stalin murdered millions and sent millions more to concentration camps. And Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge exterminated a far greater percentage of the Cambodian population than the Nazis did in Europe. And yet, neither the Stalinist nor the Khmer Rouge experiences has had the impact of National Socialism on our consciousness. Why is that? What's the difference? The reason, I believe, among others, is that unlike distant Cambodia or the Soviet Union at the periphery of Western civilization, Germany is an integral part of our civilization. It is, after all, the land of Goethe and Schiller, of Beethoven and Bach, a country which in the 1920s and 1930s had the highest literacy rate in the world, with one of the most highly developed industrial economies, a country at the forefront of scientific research and technological achievement, a country whose educational system was the envy of the world and a model for much of our own. The Germans, in other words, were not distant peasants living in, from our point of view, an undereducated or underdeveloped economically society. They were not desperately poor. They were, in other words, a lot like us. Thus, behind the ongoing interest in the National Socialist phenomenon is the haunting question, how could a political movement of such sheer barbarism come to power in such a society? And if it happened there, if it happened in Germany, could it happen elsewhere, in Europe, in the Third World? Could it happen here? Was there something fundamentally wrong with German political culture that can account for the Nazi phenomenon? Certainly some analysts have tried to track what they see as a tragic German deviation from the, quote, healthy Western norms of England, France, and the United States. There is a school of thought that I often refer to as the no Luther, no Hitler school, kind of school of thought that traces what would be a unilinear movement from the authoritarian of Lutheran theological principles through the militarism of Frederick the Great in Prussia to the authoritarianism of Bismarck to Hitler and the Third Reich, seeing National Socialism as the legitimate and logical culmination of all German political development. This line of argument is one that we will not pursue in any sort of detail today, but rather to look at a number of short-term factors that I think account for the rise of National Socialism. There are a series of other questions. What sort of people were attracted to National Socialism? They're the true believers, the committed, the ideologically committed, the genuine Nazis among the German population. But I would submit this is actually a fairly small percentage of the overall population. Millions more joined the party or voted for the party between 1928 and 1933, and then, of course, afterward in the Third Reich. Was this a case simply of collective madness, a nation gone mad? Had the Germans gone crazy? What we'll try to do in our discussions today and tomorrow is to discuss the question of who joined the NSDAP, as the party was called, who voted for it, and why. What drove millions of Germans into the Nazi camp? What role did Nazi ideology play? There's a tendency often, I think, to think that if we understand the ideology, we understand the motivations of the people that joined. I think we'll see that this is not necessarily the case. Was it simply a matter of discontent, or were people genuinely drawn to the ideas of National Socialism? What role did Nazi ideology play in this development? Did the Nazis mobilize support by articulating a set of ideas that were shared by a great many Germans, or can one see the rise of the Nazis as a response to a series of short-term crises in German political life? In 1928, the Nazis have less than 3% of the vote in Germany. By the summer of 1932, they are the largest political party in the country. It was a dramatic political ascent, and one that was in many ways unpredictable. What did people think they were getting when they voted Nazi? One of the most difficult, indeed one of the most challenging aspects of trying to approach the National Socialist phenomenon, as particularly as one thinks about the rise of National Socialism, is forgetting what we know happened. Forget what you know about what happens after 1933, and to try to place yourself in the context of Germans living in the 1920s and early 1930s, without the benefit of historical hindsight, without recognizing the horrors that the National Socialist regime would bring. If one tries to do that, and as I say, it is a daunting and indeed challenging, almost impossible thing for us to do, I think one can make giant strides toward understanding the rise of the NSDAP. In the second set of questions that we want to address, we'll turn our attention to the Nazis in power. How did the National Socialists subvert the German government? How did they break political opposition? Within a period of about 9 months, the Nazis go from being a party on the outside of power to achieving something that we would recognize as a totalitarian regime. How did they do that? Why was there so little opposition? Why was there so little resistance? We want also to look at day-to-day life in National Socialist Germany. What was it like to live in the Third Reich? To look at the experience from, quote, perspective of average Germans, and then also to look from the day-to-day life from the perspective of its victims. We want to look at the process by which the real core of Nazi ideology would bubble to the surface, how Nazi ideology was translated from the realm of theory into terrible practice. How did it manifest itself? And we will follow the terrible, tortured path of Nazi racial policy that would lead from the economic boycotts of Jewish shops in April of 1933 to the ghastly horrors of Auschwitz. How did Germans react to these policies? How did they react to the regime's measures? What was known? What was not known? We'll try to understand the regime from both perspectives. The perspective of the regime itself, the party as it unfolds its policies, as Nazi ideology becomes reality, and to look at it from the perspective of the population. These are powerful, emotionally charged issues and questions, and examining them is a wrenching experience. They go beyond questions of politics and sociology to hit on major moral dilemmas. What would you have done? Would you have recognized the evil inherent in National Socialism? And if so, would you have had the courage to act? These are the central issues that are under consideration in our deliberations, and they go beyond National Socialism and beyond the specific case of Germany and the Third Reich. They're questions, I would argue, that touch all of us in democratic societies and are fundamental to our understanding of responsibility, both political and moral, in modern civilization. Now, I'd suggested at the outset that we would not talk about long-term developments. That is, we're not going to go back and look at developments from the 16th, 17th, 18th, and early 19th centuries, but rather to focus on the crisis-ridden years of the so-called Weimar Republic between 1919 and 1933. However, I think before we turn to that, there are a number of very specific long-term factors that one at least ought to raise. Several things about German political development in the 19th century are directly relevant to the rise of National Socialism. They are, first of all, late unification and late industrialization in Germany. Germany, as you know, was the last of the major European powers to reach the status of a nation-state. It was unified only in 1871, very late in the 19th century. And the method of unification was quite important. Germany was not unified as the result of a movement of mass nationalism, of grassroots support for a German national state. On the contrary, it was unified by the force of Prussian arms. Otto von Bismarck unified Germany in a series of wars in the 1860s, in 64 against Denmark, 66 against Austria, and finally as the denouement in 1870-71 against France. The country that was created was not a united country, and this is something that Bismarck and the German leadership of the so-called German Empire, the Second Reich, quickly understood. Germany was still very deeply divided after unification by region, by religion, and by class. Germany, of course, is the home of the Protestant Reformation, was the only major European country to have a serious religious division. The overwhelming majority, about two-thirds of the population, was Protestant, with a third being Catholic, a very small Jewish population, one-half of 1%. The major religious divide was religious. It was one of the most important social, cultural, and political facts of life in the German Empire, and a very divisive chasm it was indeed. Second, there was region. It took the German authorities a long time to generate anything like a German national consciousness. Germans, even after unification in the early 1870s, still tended to see themselves by and large as Bavarians first, or Hanoverians first, or Badenese first, and Germans second. The famous poem, which would become the German national anthem, Deutschland, Deutschland über alles, Germany, Germany above all, was written not as, I think our association of it in the 20th century, having to do with German aggression toward the non-German world, but was written as a poem to emphasize the need for Germans to think about Germany above Bavaria, Germany above Prussia, Germany above the various princely and territorial states. Religion would become regional differences, particularly when they were overlain with religious divisions, were tremendously powerful in Germany, as was class. Germany would experience the Industrial Revolution much later than England or France. The nature of German industrialization was extremely important. When industrialization came to Germany in the last half of the 19th century, it came, to use the sociologist Ralph Dahrendorf's classic phrase, it came late, it came fast, and it was extremely thorough. Germany goes from being essentially a backward agrarian country in 1850 to being one of the most dynamic, heavily industrialized countries in the world by 1900. Within a generation and a half, the Ruhr is transformed from a kind of glorified cow pasture into one of the most densely industrial areas in the world. What this meant in terms of values was that in the 1890s or in 1900, and even in the 1920s, you have people living side by side who work with quite different values. You have, on the one hand, the most highly organized working class in Europe, heavy industrial workers, labor unions, a social democratic party that was a model for socialist organization around the world before 1917, living side by side with people who were still in guilds, artisans, craftsmen, who still had an old guild mentality. What this did was to produce a situation in which you have, there's a marvelous German term for this that is, like so many of these German terms, almost impossible to translate, die Gleichzeitigkeit der Ungleichzeitigen, the simultaneity or the contemporaneousness of the non-contemporary. What happens when you have two things out of, doesn't work much better in English, does it? The sense that what you have is people with different sets of values from different historical periods actually living at the same time. And this kind of social tension produces tremendous cleavages within German social life, which translate into politics. It creates an industrial versus artisan conflict. It produces urban and rural tensions, which were profoundly important. These things, I think, have to be kept in mind, and we will return to them at various points as we move on to a much more specific kind of discussion. But certainly, all of these divisions these cleavages were aggravated enormously by the events of 1914 to 1918, the First World War. The war had produced tremendous social tension in Germany. It had begun with the Kaiser making an appeal to the population in a famous speech from the summer of 1914. He went before the people and said, "I don't recognize parties any longer. I recognize only Germans." It was an appeal to put aside the very serious divisions in German political life for the duration of the war, for all Germans to overlook class, to overlook region, to overlook religion. But that appeal had broken down under the tremendous strains produced by the war. Over 750,000 people had starved to death in Germany or had died from starvation-related diseases on the home front in 1916, 1917. By 1917, Germany was being slowly starved to death. There was tremendous industrial tension. A wave of strikes rose in 1917 and finally washed across the country in the course of 1918, producing very, very serious problems on the home front. Moreover, the casualties at the front were absolutely devastating. Germany would suffer tremendous casualties over the course of the First World War, almost 2 million dead, another 1 million plus missing. Only Russia would lose more in absolute numbers. France would lose more per capita than Germany, but the losses were tremendous. Almost no German family was left untouched by the casualty lists of the First World War. Moreover, after all of this suffering, the army had maintained a fairly stringent control over information during the war. There was a very strong sense that Germany was winning the war. In 1918, for example, the Russians had been knocked out of the war. The Tsarist regime had collapsed. A revolution was underway in Russia. German troops were still deep inside France. Belgium was still occupied. The Americans had entered the war, but the high command continued to present the events of the war as going well. Things were going well. In the spring offensive of 1918, the offensive that was to bring victory to Germany, however, things had not turned out as the high command had planned. The offensive halted short of the great breakthrough, and by the fall of 1918, it was clear that the Allies were about to break through. As a consequence, the high command of the army had stepped aside, asked the, quote, civilian leadership of Germany to sue for peace, to accept an armistice, which civilian authorities did. It turned out to be a terrible mistake, as we shall see, because it allowed the army to sidestep responsibility for the defeat, which would come in November of 1918. For a great many Germans, the news in the second week of November that the war was over, that the war had come to a close, and with a German defeat, came as a tremendous shock. There was a sense that somehow defeat had been snatched from the jaws of victory, that the light at the end of the tunnel that had been promised by the army somehow had been blotted out. And now Germany was swept up in revolution on November 7th, 8th, 1918. The Emperor, Kaiser William II, went into exile in Holland, and a new revolutionary government had taken power in Germany, a revolutionary government made up of social democrats, left liberals, and representatives of the Catholic Center Party. Parties that had had no responsibility whatsoever for the conduct of the war. These would be the parties who would be forced to accept the terms of surrender. These would be the parties who would ultimately sign the Treaty of Versailles in the summer of 1919 and accept responsibility for the defeat. The shock of the end of the war, the shock of defeat, is something I think that can't be exaggerated, that this enormous sacrifice now appeared to have been for nothing. And now, this enormously prestigious, powerful state, the Second Empire, was gone. And what was left in its place? A provisional government made up of the outsiders of Imperial Germany, the Social Democratic Party, as I said, the left liberals, and the Catholic Center. These parties were able to call for a constituent assembly. Elections were to be held in January of 1919 to elect this constituent assembly to draft a constitution for a new republican government. That assembly, the elections for that assembly, resulted in a victory of the three parties that I've just described. But with revolutionary action going on in the capital city, the leaders of the Social Democratic Party, by far the largest of the new German parties, decided to hold the proceedings to draft a constitution not in Berlin, but rather in the provincial city of Weimar. for two reasons. One, to get the proceedings out of Berlin, where they might be held captive to revolutionary action. And second, to tap into an older tradition of German humanism, the tradition of Goethe and Schiller, rather than the tradition of the Hohenzollerns and militarism. As a consequence, the republic that would grow out of those deliberations would be known as the Weimar Republic. The new German government therefore began its life, the Weimar Republic would begin its life with a tremendous legacy of war and defeat. It would be associated with surrender. It would be associated with the hated Treaty of Versailles, which was signed in 1919, which brought a tremendous loss of territory to Germany. A clause in that treaty which forced Germany to assume full responsibility for the outbreak of the war and hence to pay reparations for the losses suffered by England, France, and Belgium during the war. The war guilt clause, it was called. And the German armed forces were reduced from several million down to 100,000. The Treaty of Versailles was seen as a dictated peace, a Diktat, as the Germans called it, and was universally hated, even by those parties that ultimately wound up signing it. And in 1918-1919, a new legend was born, the so-called stab in the back, that these parties of the left and center had somehow managed to stab the German army in the back just as victory was within its grasp. Moreover, the new Weimar authorities, faced with a chaotic situation in Germany as millions of troops returned home from the front, in many cases fully armed, didn't feel comfortable. They didn't actually bring about a full revolution. They didn't purge the old imperial civil service. They didn't purge the old imperial judiciary. And they turned to the old armed forces to help them maintain order, to help them repress what was the greatest threat they believed to stability in 1918-1919, and that would come from the radical left. Moreover, the new provisional government and the early governments of the Weimar Republic were faced with tremendous problems. A problem of demobilization. How do you move from a wartime to a peacetime economy? How do you demobilize millions of soldiers? There was no practice at this. There was no experience on which to build. There was a tremendous fear of Bolshevism in Europe and in Germany in particular. The Bolsheviks, as you know, had argued that for the revolution to succeed in Russia, it had to spread into Central Europe, into Germany in particular. So there was a fear of what was called the Bolshevization of conditions in Germany. And there was a fear of Allied invasion. The Western Allies made it quite clear that if events in Germany seemed to get out of hand and it looked like the Bolsheviks would come to power in Germany, the Allies might intervene in a military sense in Germany itself. As a consequence, the new German government found itself put under tremendous pressure in 1918-1919, and in some ways, it was born with a crisis of legitimacy from which it never really recovered. These events in 1918-1919 would cloud the future of democracy in Germany, and that clouded the cloud under which the Weimar Republic was born never really would dissipate. Nonetheless, the constitution that was drafted by these parties in Weimar was one of the most progressive constitutions in history. It granted universal suffrage. Women were enfranchised as the first in Europe. A Bill of Rights, an extraordinarily progressive Bill of Rights, and also commitments on the part of the new Weimar government to create a welfare state, social commitments, the like of which Europe had not seen. And it's something that we will have occasion to talk about, because the parties believed that voting had been manipulated in the imperial period, a radical system of proportional representation was taken up in the Weimar Constitution, which gave, in effect, it's more complicated than this, but I think not improper to say that, in effect, for every 60,000 votes that a party received in elections, they got a seat in the Reichstag. This was in order to give every political view a possibility of expression and representation. It was a tremendously democratic idea, but one doesn't have to be a wizard to foresee difficulties and the growth of what proved to be a remarkably diverse party system. There would be over 35 different political parties in Germany by 1928. The new republic then confronted tremendously serious problems, and this problem of legitimacy affected their economic choices. One of the most serious problems of the new regime was what to do about the returning veterans. During the war, the German government had paid for the war effort largely by inflating the economy. It pursued a policy of inflation. In 1918-1919, the new republican authorities continued that policy. They didn't believe that it would be possible in this transition from wartime to peacetime economy to suffer high rates of unemployment that might come with a recession. As a consequence, they self-consciously continued the wartime policy of inflation, and that, in the short term, that policy was successful. By 1922, 23, as we will see, however, it would cause problems. Nonetheless, what you see is an inflated economy, an overheated economy in 1919, 1920, and into 1921 that made economic life precarious. By 1922, 23, it would create a situation of chaos as that inflation tripped over into hyperinflation of truly hyperbolic proportions. The new Weimar government was also plagued by political instability and political terror. Major figures of the regime, particularly on the left, fell victim to a wave of right-wing terrorism in 1919 through 1923. Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, two of the leaders of the radical left in Germany, were assassinated by right-wing terrorists in 1919. Hugo Haase, another prominent figure on the left, assassinated, again, right-wing terrorists in 1919. Matthias Erzberger, a man associated with the Catholic Center Party and with the Surrender, also assassinated in 1921. Again, right-wing terrorists, and so it went. To Walter Rathenau, the economics minister in 1922. Again, by right-wing terrorists. So a wave of right-wing terrorism seizes the country in these traumatic years of the immediate post-war period. One also sees in the early years of the Weimar Republic coups of every variety. In 1919, the radical left attempts a coup d'etat to prevent the elections for this constituent assembly. In 1920, a monarchist coup, the so-called Kapp-Putsch, which was frustrated by a general strike. A communist uprising in the Ruhr, also in 1920. And then in 1923, a separatist movement in the Rhineland, another communist uprising in Hamburg, and in November of 1923, the emergence on the national scene of a minor political party in Munich, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, led by Adolf Hitler in the so-called Beer Hall Putsch. All of these attempts to overthrow the government failed, and yet they're indicative of the kind of instability that would plague the regime in these early post-war years. Moreover, there was cabinet instability. There were between 1920 and 1924, there were nine different governments in Germany, nine different cabinets. And after 1920, it was impossible to form any kind of majority government. All of these cabinets tended to be minority cabinets. So political instability, economic uncertainty, and tremendous frustration, bitterness, and anger directed toward the international scene would characterize Germany's development in the early 1920s. It was in this atmosphere of post-war social and political turmoil that the German Workers' Party, the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, was founded in Munich. It was founded by two obscure men, Anton Drexler and Karl Harrer, who founded it as a kind of debating society. When that debating society, which met at a beer hall in Munich, decided that it would become a political party, it had to register with the authorities. It had to register with the police and with the military authorities still in 1919. When it did so, it meant that somebody from the military had to come out and observe a meeting. A young man recuperating from wounds, from a gassing wound in Munich, a young corporal in the German army, was sent out to observe a meeting of the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei. That man was Adolf Hitler. He went to observe the meeting, promptly joined the party, becoming member number 55 of the German Workers' Party. Hitler, about whom we will obviously, I'd like to fill in details of Hitler's biography as we move along and not stop to digress here, except to say he'd been born in Braunau on the Inn River on the border of Germany and Austria in 1889. He had served in the German army during the First World War, had been gassed, had served as a courier, and was a man of absolutely no sort of distinguishing characteristics. There was nothing in Hitler's background to this point in his life that would have indicated that he was earmarked for anything outside of a life of utter obscurity. There was nothing to suggest that he had any sort of political acumen, anything that suggested that he had any particular sort of political skills. Nonetheless, in 1919, after Hitler's entry into the DAP, he would quickly assume the leadership of the propaganda of the party, and gradually began to transform the nature of the party from a small elitist debating society or club into a mass political organization. Membership of the DAP grew in the sort of demimonde of radical politics in Munich in 1919-1920, and it grew largely because of the talents of Adolf Hitler. I think the evidence from friends and foes alike from the Weimar period and thereafter, all are in agreement that Hitler possessed remarkable abilities as a public speaker. Again, utterly unanticipated. But Hitler quickly became the drawing card of the DAP, speaking on street corners, speaking in beer halls. It always sounds sort of ominous when one talks about these beer hall meetings in Germany. It's sort of the equivalent of speaking at the Ramada Inn in the United States. I mean, there's nothing sort of sordid or odd about this. Beer halls had a big open space down below, and now frequented mostly by American college students, I think. Then as one moves up in these beer halls, one sees meeting rooms of different sizes and then large sort of auditoriums. So it was in this sort of setting that the NSDAP, or the DAP at this point, would have its origins. By the summer of 1920, it was abundantly clear that Adolf Hitler had become the official leader of the DAP. He was attracting attention, certainly not at a national level, not even at a regional level in Bavaria, but it had become something of a hit on the right-wing radical speaking circuit in Munich itself. And he had clearly become the most important figure of the DAP. In 1920, Hitler decided to change the name of the party. DAP struck him as too one-sidedly left. He decided to change the name to something that I think to American ears always sounds very bizarre. It was the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP. It was an important shift in name because what it did was to suggest a very, very different political ambition for the NSDAP than any other political party in German political culture. The way German political parties had developed since the last quarter of the 19th century is very different from American political parties. German political parties had tended to, instead of casting their nets as broadly as possible like American parties do, German political parties had tended to identify their constituencies, to zero in on that constituency, gain its support, and then to maneuver within the Reichstag. Political parties, the liberal and conservative parties, were middle-class parties. They appealed almost exclusively to a middle-class constituency. They made virtually no effort to cross the great social divide of German politics and appeal to the very sizable German working class. Similarly, the German Social Democratic Party, which was the largest party in Germany, and after 1919, the German Communist Party, were working-class parties. They made very little effort to reach out to a middle-class constituency. They zeroed in on their working-class followers, recruited their constituencies there. The Catholic Center Party was the only party in German political culture that appealed to both workers and to members of the middle class, an urban and rural constituency, steel workers and bakers. And yet, for the Catholic Center Party, it wasn't class, but religious confession that was the key. They were appealing to Catholic workers, to Catholic shopkeepers, Catholic artisans, and so on. The NSDAP, from the very beginning, would be an enigma in German politics because it refused to play by these well-developed rules of German political culture. And the very name of the party was important in setting the party off from its competitors. National implied something on the right. Socialist implied something on the left. German, again, on the right. Workers, again, on the left. Party. Even the name itself suggested a party that was not going to be easily categorized along a political spectrum. And the program of the party followed along these same sort of unpredictable lines. The party was certainly bellicosely nationalistic. It was anti-Marxist. It talked about socialism, but a German socialism, not a Marxist socialism. It was going to win the worker for a new kind of socialism. And it was also rabidly anti-Semitic. The party, in its program of 1919, tried to win working class support, articulated the desire to win working class support for these ideas, talked about the ennoblement of the German workers, talked about a form of profit sharing, called for the nationalization of all trusts and banks in Germany, and talked about something that nobody, I think, then or subsequently has ever been able to figure out. They talked about breaking interest slavery. Whatever this meant, nobody was quite sure, but it sounded radical. It had kind of a leftist patina to it, which is exactly what they hoped. Hitler, in changing the name of the party, also changed the party's program. He would adopt in 1920 the so-called 25 points, which would remain the party program throughout its history, and that program would remain unchanged. The promises to the working class were maintained, but the new program of the Nazi Party in 1925, or the 25 points of 1920, reflected a desire to broaden its constituency. It talked about the need to protect the middle class. It talked about the need to deal with the threat of department stores. Department stores were a major target of the Nazis. and of small shopkeepers seen as an alien kind of economic development, an American development. And the major department stores in Germany were by and large Jewish-owned, which made them a very convenient target for parties such as the National Socialists. The party, in other words, with these 25 points, attempted to win the small shopkeeper, the small businessman. It denounced the Treaty of Versailles, of course, all parties did that. But it added a new feature that had been present in outline form in the original DAP program on anti-Semitism. The program stated, and I quote, "Citizens can be only those of German blood. No Jew can therefore become a Volksgenosse, a people's comrade," close quote. What we see here is a racial definition of a Jew. It's extremely important for National Socialist ideology, and the Nazis pledged themselves to expel all Jews from public life. At the same time, during the following years, in 1920, 21, and into 1922, Hitler was tireless in his efforts to expand his influence. He brought the party in Munich under his control, and he expanded his influence into Bavaria, winning support of other right-wing radical groups, and was able to put the NSDAP on the map of kind of this group of radical political parties in Germany. Nonetheless, at the beginning of 1923, the NSDAP was still little more than a kind of radical party in the lunatic fringes of German politics. Nobody at the national level paid attention to the Nazis. They were seen as really quite a minor curiosity in the German party system. 1923 would change all that. 1923 would be a year of extraordinary chaos. It began with the French and Belgian invasion of the Ruhr in January. The French and Belgians maintained that Germany had reneged on its reparations payments and therefore marched into the industrial heartland of Germany to extract those reparations. The government called for a policy of passive resistance, but workers in the Ruhr had to be paid. As a consequence, the German government began printing money. Inflation, which had grown dramatically in late 1922, tripped over really into hyperinflation in early 1923. To give you some indication of what we're talking about here, if you'd been at the Munich train station trying to change a dollar in 1914, that dollar would have brought you 5 Reichsmarks. By the end of the First World War, that same dollar in the Munich train station would have brought you 14 Reichsmarks. In 1921, 64 Reichsmarks. At the end of at the beginning of 1922, 191 Reichsmarks. So you can see the level of inflation is going up fairly dramatically. But nothing prepared the Germans for what 1923 would bring. In January, a dollar would bring you 17,972 Reichsmarks at the train station. By August of 1923, that same dollar would bring you about 110,000 Reichsmarks. Thereafter, it was almost impossible to calculate the rates of exchange. Banks were given permission to print their own currency. They were printed on everything, bed sheets, pillowcases, in many cases simply taking existing currency and stamping zeros after the bills. By November of 1923, $1 bill would have brought you 4,420,000,000,000 Reichsmarks. Life in Germany by the autumn of 1923 had assumed an absolutely surrealistic quality. A streetcar ticket in Berlin sold for 100,000 marks. By the end of November 1923, you would have needed 4,500,000 marks to take a 2-mile ride on the S-Bahn. By November, 150 million. A Hausfrau needed 90 billion marks to buy a kilo of potatoes in October of 1923. People were paid 3 times a day. When you arrived at work in the morning, you were paid, and you had one of your children, or if possible your wife or husband, accompany you so that he or she could take that money off and instantly buy lunch, because your money by lunchtime would be so devalued you couldn't buy anything. You were paid again at lunchtime, and again so you could buy things for dinner. You were fairly safe until the next day because the stock market closed at 5. I think you've probably all seen photographs of children building houses out of paper money, or to people with wheelbarrows full of money going down to the shops. Life, one German glumly observed, was madness, nightmare, desperation, and chaos. As the savings of millions of Germans was wiped out, people living on fixed incomes found themselves in desperate situations. Trust funds vanished. This inflation of such catastrophic proportions devastated substantial segments of the middle class. In the midst of this economic chaos, the political fabric of the Republic began to unravel. A separatist movement began in the Rhineland, supported by the French, and rumors of a communist coup in Saxony and in Thuringia led to serious government repression there. It was in this situation that Adolf Hitler enlisted the NSDAP in a conspiracy to overthrow first the Bavarian government and then to march on Berlin. His idea was to follow Mussolini's example from the March on Rome in the previous year, to seize power in Bavaria first and then to march on, quote, Red Berlin. The coup got underway on the evening of November 8th, 9th. November 8th and 9th tends to be a very big date in 20th century German history. It began at a beer hall in Munich. The events of the so-called beer hall putsch, I'm not going to go through. It was a catastrophe from beginning to end. Follows sort of like the script of an Italian comic opera. It was sort of, nobody turned out where they were supposed to be. It was a fiasco, ending with shots ringing out as government troops halted this procession of National Socialist Conservatives and others around the Feldherrnhalle. The beer hall putsch on November 8th and 9th was a fiasco. But, and we'll conclude this first session with this, Hitler turned his trial into a tremendous political success. In February and March of 1924, the major conspirators were brought to trial in Munich. Hitler, Erich Ludendorff, one of the heroes of the First World War, as well as a number of other Nazis. The trial attracted considerable attention in Germany because it took place just at the outset of a national electoral campaign. The national media focused on events in Munich at the trial. And whereas the other conspirators, including Ludendorff, tended to equivocate, Hitler took the stand in his own defense and turned the trial into a major public relations victory. He attacked the November criminals, the Social Democrats, the left liberals, the Catholic Center, for selling out Germany. He attacked the slavery of Versailles. He argued in this a rhetorical device, if being opposed to Versailles is treason, I'm guilty. If wanting to see Germany return to a position of power is a crime, I'm guilty. If wanting to throw off the guilt of the war is a crime, I'm guilty, and so on. Even the state prosecutor praised the nationalist motives of the NSDAP and wound up singing Hitler's praises. It was a bizarre proceedings, to say the least. The sentencing in April, amid the Reichstag campaign, was a national event, which was again widely covered in the German media. Ludendorff and a number of others were acquitted. Hitler was sentenced to 5 years, the minimum sentence, for attempting to overthrow the government. He was convicted of high treason and dished out a sentence of 5 years. Here, the failure to purge the judiciary is indeed important. And, in its remarks, the court expressly held out the probability of early pardon for Hitler. The beer hall putsch put the NSDAP on the map. Hitler's trial in February and March made Hitler, if not a household name in Germany, it gave the party national prominence and put it in a position to launch a national drive for membership and to win support in 1925, when, indeed, Hitler would emerge from prison after 1 year of serving his sentence.